Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World.
Once again, Americans are getting ready for a presidential election that is widely described as the most important in their lifetime. That's not the first and probably not the last time the mantra will be used, and it may even be true this time. Certainly, it is true that the two candidates, former President Trump and Vice President Harris, are about as different could be. There is little more than a month of campaigning before the November 5th election day, although voting has already started in some states. The first Tuesday in November has become the last day one can vote and the first day in which votes can be counted, only in America. So what's going to happen? Or better put, how will the candidates try to break what appears to be a tie, according to most polls? My guest today is steeped in politics. Scott Miller is arguably one of the country's most successful political and corporate strategists, with a long list of successful campaigns behind him. Probably a few others, but we're not going to talk about those today. He is an equal opportunity advisor, having cashed checks from prominent Republicans as well as Democrats. If anyone has insight, Scott does. Welcome, Scott, to New Thinking for a New World.
Yeah, you came to the wrong guy for New Thinking. I'm so old. I've been through so many elections. It should have made me wise. And I probably thought I was up until this one.
Okay, we'll test this proposition in a minute. So let's start at 50,000 feet. Campaigns, as you know much better than I, are about defining who you are and, if you can get away with it, who you're running against. Two quotes that, at least for me, say a lot about each candidate and their respective worldviews. From Donald Trump, quote, "Our country is being lost. We're a failing nation," unquote. That's the half-empty glass. From Kamala Harris, quote, "I can imagine what will be, unburdened by what was," unquote. And that's the half-full glass. Put aside hyperbole and word salad. Who are these people?
Well, that's going to be the question, obviously, as you said, that people take in at the voting booth with them or have already put in the mail or early voting. My assumption, and I haven't seen anything to contradict it this time, is that early voting breaks along party lines. I mean, they know who they're going to vote for and they vote for them. It's sort of baked in. But there's going to be this huge element of undecided. In 2016, in our national polling, in the last 10 days, 25% of voters said they were, and they were, these were registered and, you know, ready to vote voters, said they were undecided because they didn't like either candidate. I suspect that that's going to be the case this time. Nearly that many. Maybe 20%, that, you know, they call them the persuadables. I'm not sure they're persuadable. So it's going to be interesting. And the question is, yeah, who are they? If indeed Vice President Harris is the future, and she's done a terrific job of trying to change the context from liberal conservative to new versus old. If she's new, she probably wins. If she's more the same, she probably loses. If Trump is, well, everybody knows he's more the same. I mean, they know exactly what to expect. The question is, do they go to the voting booth and say, he's just too freaking crazy? I can't do it. Back in 16, those 25% went into the voting booth with one dominant thought in mind. If Hillary wins, the elites in Washington win. They responded 2-1 yes on that question. And that's pretty much the way they voted. On election day, Trump won all seven of the battleground states. He won in a day, at least that voting day, a landslide. This is totally different, though. Can I talk a little bit about the voters?
Well, that actually is where I was going to go with this, because the question, there's caricatures for both sets of voters, and I put air quotes on Republican and Democrat, for Harris versus Trump. There's caricatures. We have the caricature Trump voter, undereducated, white male, runs around the Capitol on January 6th wearing horns. You've got this image of, to use Hillary's famous word, deplorables. On the Democrat side, you have this sort of pipe smoking, if they still exist, a liberal academic in Ann Arbor or somewhere. Yep. And those are extreme. Those are caricatures. So one of the big unknowns, certainly as I talk to people who tend to be more liberal inclined in their votes, they don't have a clue who in their right mind would vote for Trump. Yet 75 million people did last time and will this time. So who votes for Trump and who votes for Ms. Harris?
There has been a transformation of the Democratic Party in my lifetime. When I joined the party in Boston back in the late 1960s, early 1970s, the Democratic Party was a blue-collar party. Decidedly, it was the hairy-armed sons of toil. It was Tip O'Neill. I mean, that transformation through probably, maybe the tipping point was during the Clinton campaign, Bill Clinton, it has been exceptional. It is urban, advanced degree, certainly college educated. Just the caricature that you portrayed, that's a lot of the party, as well as longstanding older Democrats who are just faithful to the party, minorities who trust them better. Blacks still trust the Democrats more than the Republicans. Hispanics are in play. Asians are in play. So who's voting for her? As you said, about 75 million people are going to vote for her. In 20, 155 million people voted. And as you well know, and as everybody listening to this knows, it really came down to three states and about 44,000 votes that decided that election. This time it's six states: Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona, maybe Nevada. Now, when you look at voters and you think of the Trump voters, obviously, the caricatures probably live on the maybe 20% level of their of those voters, of the hard support, loyalists. But the fact is, a majority of our voters in this election and all our national elections are working class, which means they have no college degree. They have less than $100,000 income. Demographically, they're across the board. They're everything. But they have a lot of things in common. They're pragmatic, highly pragmatic by necessity. As you know, $400 will put them in bankruptcy, an unexpected bill. So they're very, very careful. They're moderate by circumstances because they do not choose their gated community. They probably go to the church their parents went to. They probably send their kids to the school they went to. And when they go out on a work crew in the morning, they go with whoever the hell the company sends them out with. So they just learn to get along. They become fairly moderate socially and remarkably kind, or at least surprisingly to me, they're very, very hawkish about spending. They don't trust free stuff from the government. Now, Trump characterizing the country as in decline, and I know the media particularly says it's a negative, very negative black view of the country. The American people pretty much agree. I mean, the right track, wrong track numbers in every election, you know, are we on the right track or are we on the wrong track? They're, you know, 25-75 wrong track. And that's everybody.
75 wrong track, 25 right track.
Yeah, they're sour. And the undecideds are more sour than anybody else. They're undecided not because they can't decide between these two incredible candidates, but because they don't like what they've been served up by the country, by the system, by politics itself. So again, the question is, if Vice President Harris can get them to look forward, and that's a big deal. And I have to say, I mean, you know, about the Harris campaign, it's been a stunningly good campaign to me. I mean, considering how it began, her approval rating when it began was about 35%, right in Trump territory, lower, in fact, than Trump, lower than Biden. And it is now at 45 and probably rising. So that's kind of amazing in the short time that she's been campaigning. She came out, to my surprise, with great discipline. But, you know, there was the selection. I don't know what that process could, the history will decide how that weekend went on the 27th. You know, how Joe gave up power. But the energy that was restored at the party was amazing. The convention was just about perfect as a vibe convention, as she described it. She's had momentum. She won the debate. She kicked his ass. She, you know, seems, and all the media is, you know, all the liberal media is certainly with her. The mainstream media is with her. You know, at this point in way back in 88, Dukakis was up by 22 points. And she should be up by 15 or 20.
That's exactly the point. That's the mystery of this campaign, because not. She is doing better in the polls, at least, than Biden was, but that doesn't say very much, and more or less tied. So she got her bump. She got back what Biden had lost. And we're sitting here, again, a month or so away from the election, and it's a coin toss.
Yeah, somewhere between toss-up and tight. And you know, I watch the poll, obviously, daily. And recently, there are two pollsters that I really watch closely because they have great credibility for me. And I call them the two Nates. It's Nate Silver, formerly of 538, now called the Silver Bulletin, and Nate Cohn, who does the polling for the New York Times. Now, the New York Times is obviously clearly all in, as all in as you can be for Kamala Harris. But their polling is excellent. Their New York Times Siena polls have been really, really thoughtfully put together and really good. But, you know, they don't lead you much of anywhere either, as much as I trust these guys. And they can show you that last week they were saying, well, Trump's got the electoral college advantage, and this week maybe she does. This week, you know, recently, the last time they polled Siena, Trump was moving up in North Carolina, Georgia, and in Arizona. And I mean, I didn't feel, I live in Georgia. She's being outspent about 5-1 in this state, and as you know, this is a sort of a purple state already. It's very much a mix, but he's gaining. He's gaining in North Carolina, and this is the polling had not quite gotten to the governor, the candidate for governor, and what effect that may have long term. Doesn't seem like it would, because in Arizona, the Senate candidate, Carrie Lake, is losing ground and Trump is gaining ground. And here's one, folks, if you really want to understand the race clearly. Tell me why Trump is closing the gap, ever so slightly, but closing the gap on the issue of abortion. I mean, this is one of the most puzzling elections. But then next week and the week after that, there'll be different polls. But it's going to be, what do they go into the voting booth with? And interestingly, in 16, and I said that, you know, Trump got a big boost at the very end. Also, he spent 10 days, just 10 days, totally on message, going 8 states a day in his Trump plane into the battleground states while Mrs. Clinton was essentially shuttling between New York and California to get the money she needed to pay for a $1 billion campaign. Trump's campaign was $100 million campaign in that time. And Trump was on message. He was saying, it's not about me, it's about you. You're the message, I'm the messenger. I mean, that's totally unheard of for a narcissistic sociopath. But that's what he did, and that's how he moved away. Now, he's run a terrible campaign. At the same time, she's run a great campaign. He's run a sort of meandering campaign. Yes, there was some sympathy for assassination attempt number one, and maybe number two, but it's not been a great campaign. And J.D. Vance has not been a terrific addition, but, you know, J.D. Vance and Tim Walz don't count, believe me.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on talbergfoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
Let's underline that, because especially our international audience doesn't recognize that vice presidents, as you just said, vice presidential candidates don't count. They may have a very tiny impact in one particular place, but I don't think there's ever been an election in the modern period where it was won or lost by a vice president.
And people could remember, you know, Lloyd Benson was a terrific vice presidential nominee by Dukakis. Geraldine Ferraro for Mondale. And they both lost in landslides. So it's not a deal. And no matter what you think of either one, don't worry about it. Now, so far, and as I say, if people go into the booth saying she represents more of the same, she loses. And the undecided, the ones who, the persuadables, those 44, 55, 75,000 votes that will decide this election in those battleground states, if they're saying, you know, really just more of the same, 63% of all voters say we need major change. 32% say we need minor change at least. So, you know, 95% say we need change. That's a pretty strong burden if she cannot divorce herself completely from Biden, Bidenomics, and from the last 3 years. Now, again, think of those working class voters. They don't think about inflation, and they don't listen to, you know, the Fed, and they don't listen to Janet Yellen. They go to the supermarket, and prices have been up and up. Gas has been up, still is, even though it's less up. It's, you know, rent and mortgages have been up. And for 2.5 years, that's a real sting. Now, things have improved for sure, but it's improving on a really bad situation for those people. So will they take that into the booth, that sting of it cost them maybe $8,000 that they absolute positively did not have? Now, Trump voters, again, the loyalists are the loyalists, and they're going to, you know, they're going to vote Trump, and they don't care what he does. you know, they find an excuse for anything he says or does, as he's always said. And he rode through in 16, he rode through three or four, I know, assassination attempts, but he had suicide attempts. When he was first won the election, or won the nomination by winning the Wisconsin primary, he took on Judge Curiel in Indiana, this obscure but Hispanic judge who had ruled somewhere, sometime against some business that Trump had. You know, the Democrats had a very flat convention that was essentially stolen from Bernie Sanders. And what does he do? He attacks the Kahn family, the Gold Star family, you know, and goes after the Miss Puerto Rico for being ugly. And then there's Access Hollywood. And you keep thinking, geez, does he really want to be president? But the people pulled them through. Now we'll see. The interesting thing, when I go back to the two Nates, Nate Cohn of the New York Times, in the last, not the most recent, but maybe less than a month ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, our time, that he said, look, in these polls, Trump is more popular than he has ever been. Now, I know that's from a really low base, but he's more popular than he's ever been. Furthermore, he's seen as a centrist. Now, that, you know, again, for many on the call, that'll seem outlandish, but he's seen as a centrist, not too liberal, not too conservative. So we say, you know, among those, and he projects this negative view of America going down the drain and everybody's laughing at us in the world. 57-13, the undecideds right now say, I'm worse off than I was 4 years ago. And, you know, it's a really tough situation. But is he going to, are they going to go in there and say he's just too damn crazy? Now, abortion,
before we go to abortion, let me just pick up on that for a second, because I was talking recently to a liberal college professor who does politics exactly about Trump voters. And he said for his sins, he's gone to a number of Trump rallies. And the big surprise to him is how normal, his word, not mine, how normal the people are at Trump rallies, how happy they are, how upbeat they are. I wasn't reading Mark Meadows' former chief of staff biography, but someone sent me his quote describing a Trump rally and the people there. And he said, he wrote, in general, I found them to be some of the kindest, most generous people I've ever met. Almost the opposite of the caricature that we have of who we, air quotes, think are Trump supporters. And your point is, as Mark Meadows, as my liberal Middlebury friend is, they're normal people.
They are normal people, just as, forget the pipe smoking collegiate impression of Democrats. The people who support Vice President Harris are normal people. Very much the same. We did research in Eastern Ohio, Western Pennsylvania, among Trump's hard support loyalists who had voted for him. We did it in 2017. And things were kind of chaotic. What was interesting was that normalness. Were they sitting on the edge of their seats in MAGA hats watching Fox News? No. They were thinking about the transmission on the van, their mother-in-law's gallbladder, the kid's game on Friday night. They returned to life. And when they said two things about the election, one was they felt they had done their duty. They had done something they had to do, and they had just done it. And they felt good about doing it. They didn't regret that at all.
Their duty was to vote.
For Trump. To vote against the elites in Washington. And they said, maybe not all of them, but many, many of them said, I thought when he was elected, he'd act like president. And what they meant by that was they had been watching for 14 years The Celebrity Apprentice, in which Donald J. Trump was an august, you know, sober, mature CEO sitting at a conference table, often with a rainbow coalition of celebrities in front of him, and, you know, family around him. That was Mark Burnett, the producer, more than it was Trump himself. But yeah, they were very, very normal. And that's, you know, they're good people. And the people who are fed up with the country and where it's going and want radical change, they're pretty much like their neighbors. You know, I know how divided we're supposed to be. I can tell you how, and this gets to a key point. I'm going to tell you how united we are. Something's holding back Kamala Harris. We know what's holding back Trump is he's a maniac and he's not, he only worries about himself, all of that. Everybody knows the whole thing. But something mysterious is holding her back. And yes, I know there's racism and I know there's sexism and there's the anti-Biden ism. Something bigger. And I think it may be part of what unites us. In our research for the last, 10, 12 years, something remarkable has been in that research, which is this rising tide of alienation and frustration with politics, the system, and our government. And 84% of all voters of all demographics, of all political stripes, agree with this statement. An elite of incumbent politicians of both parties, lobbyists, big banks, big unions, big business, big special interests, big media in Washington, D.C., rigged the system to protect their own power and prestige. We're united in that feeling as Americans. And I think that's what's holding back Kamala Harris. And I think it holds back Donald Trump as well. It's what making this a toss-up is not just that they're having trouble deciding between the two. It's so distasteful to them because they believe that the system is so broken. They believe that it's made our government inept and corrupt. And they used to say, up until about 4 years ago, they would say, it takes good people and makes them corrupt. Now they say it attracts corrupt people and makes them politicians. So there's this damper on our elections that I think goes beyond the personality of the individuals. It's I hate this, what's going on here. And that may be the damper that's sort of holding her back from where she should be running away with it, by all the kind of campaign experience I've had. I admire what they've done. And then she did it, remarkably, pretty much with the Biden campaign. And I was convinced that President Biden had the worst communications team of anybody ever in the White House. And yet, with the addition of a couple of Jim Messina and David Plouffe, she's run a miraculously good campaign. And they've made, they have turned abortion into a transactional issue, which is important with working class voters, which they look for issues where you can say, if I vote for this person, this will happen. And Trump says, I'll be your protector to women. It's a little vague. But she said, I'm going to reinstate Roe v. Wade as the national. Well, she can't, but forget it. But that's what she wants to do. And that's sort of a trend. That's where I'm going to do that. It's very certain. So that may play a part in the very end. But there is an overriding, I guess, sourness, not depression, but anger. Our people are ornery to begin with, and that's great. But but right now, I think there's a pernicious quality to this situation because they don't trust government. They don't trust big institutions. They don't trust colleges. They don't trust church. They don't trust. They're losing their trust. They obviously lost their trust in the media. So I think that may be it. Obviously, there are other things. You know, racism is real. You know, a woman of color, that's a double negative with some people. But, and we'll see how many. And, you know, they say that Trump gets maybe a 4-point boost when the curtain closes. People who will not tell a pollster that they're voting for Trump, that they vote for him. But at the same time, you know, there may be people who will vote for Harris who wouldn't, you know, wouldn't have said so to, you know, to their friends. So it's a really puzzling election for me. I'm supposed to know. And more people call me because of that. Now my good friends text me and say, since I'm not on either side, saying, what do you think? What do you think? And I hate to say it, but it doesn't make any difference what I think.
Before we end, let me ask you on behalf of the audience. So we've got 4 or 5 weeks left. What are the signposts along the way in these next few weeks that might tell you that, for example, Kamala Harris has solved the problem and is going to start getting not just back to where Biden should have been, but taking charge of the race, or that Trump somehow he's already building on his past performance, but really outperform his past performance. Well, what do you as a professional who've done this for a long time look for in these closing weeks?
Recently, James Carville was interviewed and he said, I just got this feeling there's going to be a twist and a turn, you know, because there have been so many already. And it's hard to believe we could go a month without some dramatic something happening.
Sure, let me interrupt because President Zelensky of Ukraine was actually out on the campaign trail in Pennsylvania for Kamala Harris, which is pretty damn close to unprecedented. And I would have thought if I were advising the Harris campaign, I would have said, oh, my God, don't have anywhere near Pennsylvania. We don't want foreigners coming and tell us how to vote, whether Republican or Democrat. Is that the sort of thing that could boomerang and actually begin to make a difference?
Yeah. There is a momentum is a magical force, as you know, Napoleon and everyone else is. You know, in Lombardy and every great thinker has realized that if she gets a real lead, a 5, a 6, then people begin to say, huh. And they begin to think, okay, maybe I could see her as president. Same thing for Trump. If there is there's been a leveling off for the vice president, without question. As I said, I'm grasping to understand quite what it is. But there is the fact that she's avoided detail, that she's avoided policy, that she's faced up to some of the key questions that people have on prices, on immigration. That could give Trump a boost. And again, if somebody gets to 5 or 6 in the national polls, it'll narrow at the very, very end. If they get there, then I'm going to say they know what they're doing. And it'll be really easy to tell if Trump is on message or, you know, wandering around the, you know, playing to the front row. What's he calling this? Saturday Night Joes? It's Front Row Joes. That's what he called them at the rallies. That's what when he's playing to those people, he's not playing to America. But, you know, what your friend from Middlebury described was the people who are in the back. I look on January 6th of 2021, I looked at that early in the day and I said, looks like a state fair. I mean, people kind of wandering around with American flags and they look saying hi to each other and stuff. You know, I hadn't seen the Proud Boys yet. And I hadn't seen, you know, all the chaos. So, and then some could happen. I mean, something dramatic could happen. I can't imagine Vice President Harris doing a major screw up. I mean, and Trump can do a major screw up and cruises through it. It's that's expected. Now, I just think somebody's either going to get some momentum or something hugely dramatic that we don't foresee. And a month is a long time to go in this election without something hugely dramatic happening.
Let's leave it there, Scott. We have a month. Maybe we should visit either just before November 5th or just after. I'm not sure, because my biggest fear is that this is going to be a long count.
I think so. Yes. Either way, by the way.
Yeah, that's an important point. Either way, both parties are in fact gearing up with lawyers and et cetera for an election day that starts the season, not ends the season.
We've all forgotten 2000. I mean, you know, Gore v. Bush.
I don't think he has.
Yeah, I bet not. I mean, how many days did that go on? Like 31 or something?
Almost as long as it could before it started hitting some really important dates that could have.
Yeah. And we have a barely functioning president. So I think that's another drama coming. But maybe next time we'll talk, we'll be talking about that crazy thing that happened. We'll see.
Thank you very much. The whole world is watching this time. That is certainly true. Whether or not it's the most important election, that old 60s mantra, the whole world's watching. Thank you very much for helping us understand what we're watching.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.